Okay? If you insist on communicating, text each other. You do it all day and all night anyway, don't you? So you don't need to be talking right now. Okay, the topic for today is political entrepreneurship and the economics of wealth destruction. And what I want to do is talk about the difference between political entrepreneurship and market entrepreneurship, and the consequences of that, the economic consequences of that. Now, several people have mentioned throughout the week the old ancient theory. It's associated with Franz Oppenheimer, among other people, that there are two ways to make money. One is to be involved in the production of goods and services for your fellow man and on the marketplace, either as an employee or as a business owner or entrepreneur, whatever role, or using the power of the state to plunder your neighbor and steal their income legally. Two ways to get money. Okay, but there's a little more to it than that. That is certainly true. There's two ways to make money, but the first way, is associated with market entrepreneurship. And what is market entrepreneurship? You've had Peter Klein gave an outstanding lecture on entrepreneurship, and a couple of other people have talked about it. But essentially, the bottom line is producing goods and services for your fellow man in return for money. One of the famous slogans from The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, is he described the market in the following way: give me that which I want, and I will give you that which you want. That's the market. That's capitalism. It kind of infuriates people when I'm ever in a debate over capitalism, and I tell them, well, that's what it is, because a lot of people think of it, as Tom Woods described, as a bunch of big fat guys chomping on cigars with monocles, holding big bags of gold in each arm. That's capitalism. But that's basically what it is. And so the market entrepreneur is someone who strives to, day in and day out, to provide better things and cheaper things for customers, because that's how to get rich. If you ever had a chance to read the chapter of Human Action called The Market, so I forget what number the chapter is, but there are a lot of gems in there. One of the gems is how von Mises explains how so many of the modern conveniences that we all take advantage of, all take for granted, like refrigeration and cars, were almost all of them, not in every single instance, but almost all of them were first invented by somebody who, because they weren't produced on a large scale, were very expensive and were only available to the wealthiest people in a country. But then the entrepreneurs figured out that the way to become really, really wealthy, now the John D. Rockefellers, the Andrew Carnegies of the 19th century, was to mass produce this stuff so cheaply that just about anybody could afford it. And, high volume, low margin. That's how to make big, big, big money. That's how the Bill Gateses of the world are created in our day, or the John D. Rockefellers of the 19th century of that time. And so that's what market entrepreneurs do. And of course, political entrepreneurs do pretty much the opposite. And there is literature in economics that tries to compare political entrepreneurs to market entrepreneurs. There are quite a few articles. There's a big section of public choice economics that attempts to model the state as a market. There's even a book called The State as a Market in the public choice literature. But of course, what a political entrepreneur does is to be good at legal plunder. He's good at stealing legally, stealing from one person, keeping a good portion, if not most of it, for himself and his cronies, and throwing a few crumbs to the peasants who will faithfully vote for him in the next election cycle. And that's the essence of what political entrepreneurship is and everything that is involved in politics. Now, these are old ideas. These are not necessarily unique to Austrian economics. But one other aspect of this is that the literature in public choice economics does a pretty decent job in clarifying the economic implications of this distinction between political entrepreneurship and market entrepreneurship under the rubric of rent seeking, which is, you know, one of the clunkiest terms in all of economics. I prefer plunder seeking because very few people, even economic students, understand what economic rent is anyway. And plunder is much more descriptive of what's going on here. And of course, rent seeking is use of time, effort, money to acquire an income transfer from somebody else through the aegis of the state, you know, using the state, lobbying the state to procure some sort of income transfer. A corporation and its labor unions lobbying for protectionist tariffs to block foreign competition so they can raise the price of what they sell and split the loot, the monopoly loot as a result. Lobbying for onerous regulations that will disproportionately harm your competitors. That's rent-seeking. Lobbying for monopoly franchise, such as in the cable industry. I can remember when Washington, D.C. finally got its monopoly franchise for cable television, it was in the 80s, and all the other jurisdictions around had already had cable TV, but the Washington, D.C. government was playing this game, this endless game of soliciting bids from about a dozen or so different cable companies, and the cable companies would wine and dine the politicians, the city councilmen and the mayor, and they would bring them to their annual cable conference in Hawaii every January. They would give their spouses jobs in their companies, and this just went on and on. Finally, the voters were just fed up with this. You know, all the Virginia and Maryland suburbs had had cable TV for years, but not the nation's capital. So they had to finally hand out the bid. And it came out in the Washington Post when they finally gave out the bid that members of the mayor's campaign staff and the city councilman were given shares of stock in the winning company. They got the monopoly. And just a couple years later, 3 or 4 years later, I read an article in the Washington Post about how some of these people had cashed in their stock for between $5 and $15 million. And so that's how it's done. And so that's an example of rent seeking. And so the economic implication of this, though, in terms of wealth destruction, is that the opportunity cost of all the time, effort, and money that is spent acquiring money to influence government is time, effort, and money that could have been spent producing goods and services alternately. So the more time people spend lobbying, spending their money on campaign contributions rather than in the economy and doing all the other things involved in politicking, well, by definition, that's less time that is spent in the productive sector. The more students who go to law school to become public relations people and lobbyists and move to Washington, well, then the fewer we're going to have young people getting engineering degrees or business degrees or accounting degrees and entering the productive sector where the domain of market entrepreneurship thrives. Okay, that's the opportunity cost. And so the late Mansur Olson wrote several books on this. He was a public choice economist. Mansur Olson, and he had a memorable little parable he used to describe the effects on wealth of rent seeking. And the parable is: imagine two Japanese sumo wrestlers. You know, the big fat guys in diapers, and they wrestle in a circle. And I guess whoever has the bigger belly and can bounce the other guy out of the circle wins. So imagine them in one of these small little shops in College Avenue in Auburn that sells nothing but china, you know, glassware, dishes and things. And it's one of these crowded little shops where you walk through the aisles like this to look at the china. And here come these two big guys and they go at it. Whoever wins the match, whoever wins the sumo match, gets to keep whatever china or glasses, goblets are left. And there's one left, you know, one little glass that somehow survived. And the winner walks out onto College Street, you know, probably with this one goblet. And of course, the idea is that you have the potential to destroy a lot more wealth than the winner gets, such as in the cable TV example. Well, the winning company got a monopoly franchise on cable television in Washington, D.C., worth many millions of dollars. But it's possible that the 10 or 12 years of a dozen or more companies diverting management talent and diverting money and everything else to trying to acquire that monopoly, overwhelmed, in terms of the amount of money involved, was even much higher than the value of the monopoly to that firm over the competitive profit it could have made just as a competitive profit somewhere else by investing its capital somewhere else. And so that's how wealth is destroyed. And it's at best, rent seeking is at best a zero sum game, but I've always thought it has to be a negative sum game. But you transfer resources from the private sector to the plunder sector, you have to be destroying resources. Just one example of this is even the government, the Congressional Accounting Office, which has a new name now. They try to reinvent themselves. Once there's a scandal, they change the name. So they kind of like how Puff Daddy changed his name to P. Diddy, thinking no one would recognize him after he got in trouble with a shooting in New York City some years ago. He thought if he called himself Piff Diddy, nobody will know who it is. I guess it's a true story. They've done many studies of government jobs programs, and you can find these online. You Google it. And I've read some where they said for every government job where, the government gives you a job painting fake doors on government buildings or something like that, and they pay you $30,000, it might cost as much as $250,000 in overhead to give one person a $30,000 or $40,000 job because the bureaucracy is like a black hole that just eats up money. And so if you transfer – And that's easy to see how that would destroy wealth. Take $250,000 out of the economy, and the person that benefits does benefit. Yeah, he does, but he gets a $30,000 or maybe $40,000 job, but it costs other people $250,000 to give him that job. Okay, and that's sort of how it happens. And so, also related to this is some of the writings of Murray Rothbard's favorite American political philosopher, John C. Calhoun. And John C. Calhoun was a vice president, secretary of war. He's a United States senator from South Carolina. And he was also the last who wrote philosophical tracts about government in the spirit of the American founding fathers. He was really the last Jeffersonian in terms of writing books on political philosophy of that era, the 18th, 19th century America. And his book, A Disquisition on Government, was cited by Rothbard many times over in many of Murray's writings. And one of the things Calhoun did in his writings, in his book, A Disquisition on Government, which is online, and you can buy it, I don't know if it's for sale downstairs or not, is he wrote an expose about the libertarian class theory. And he doesn't use the words libertarian class theory, but that's what it was, because its origins were in France in the 1600s, really. The Europe of the 17th century is where libertarian class theory began, before Karl Marx's class theory. The Marxian class theory began as the working class being antagonistic toward the capitalist class. But a libertarian class theory has different classes. It doesn't talk about class struggle in that context. The classes are the net tax-paying class, people who pay more in taxes than they get back in any benefits from government, and the net tax-consuming class. These are people who get more from government than they pay in taxes. Government employees, for example, people on welfare, recipients of corporate welfare, and so forth. And Calhoun wrote about this, and he, just relying on what he had read from the 17th century French philosophers and others, and predicted that the net tax consumers in any democracy would inevitably overwhelm the net tax payers in any democracy, and they will do anything to do it. They will say anything and do anything. They will, if you have a written constitution, Calhoun said, then there will be a relentless pursuit of the emaciation of that Constitution and the reinterpretation of every word of it that that helps to limit government, and so that it will be turned around to create unlimited government. That's why Calhoun favored, he favored something called a concurrent majority, where he said it's not enough for the Supreme Court, or even the Supreme Court, the President, and the Congress to weigh in on what is and is not constitutional, according to this written document. He said the people of the states, either as an individual state or a collection of states, should also have some kind of veto power over all federal legislation, so that they would also have a say in what is and is not constitutional. Now, back in those days, we did not live in America under a regime of black-robed deities. Jefferson, for example, would have started sharpening his sword and buying firearms if he thought the day had come where everyone's liberty in the whole country was in the hands of five government lawyers with lifetime tenure. That's the system we live under today. It's called the Supreme Court. Because in his day, the understanding was Congress is an equal branch of the Supreme Court. So is the presidency, and so are the states. They're equal. They're more equal. Under the 10th Amendment, all the power is not delegated to the U.S. government under the Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution are reserved to the people and the states. And so that's the way America was run in those days. And Calhoun was right, of course. We have arrived at that day. We arrived at that day a long time ago in the United States, where the tax eaters, the tax consumers, have overwhelmed or outnumbered the taxpayers. You may have seen these statistics saying that, something like the top 50% of taxpayers in United, or income earners in terms of income earning pay something like 97% of all federal taxes in the United States. And no one has to pay any federal taxes until you make at least $45,000 in the United States. And so everyone in that category has every incentive to vote for tax increase after tax increase after tax increase, more spending, more spending, more spending, because it's all free. They don't pay. And so that's the system that has been arranged in the United States for us. And so Calhoun was on to this. And that's why he also was an advocate of the Jeffersonian ideas of nullification and secession. These were Jefferson. Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. That's our document that allowed us to secede from the British Empire. And he also wrote the Kentucky Resolve of 1798, which enunciated the principle of nullification, whereby the citizens of a state could nullify a federal law and simply not pay attention to it, not enforce it. And this was not Calhoun. These were not Calhoun's ideas. He just followed through on ideas that were not even Jefferson's. They preceded Jefferson. These ideas were alive in the colonies before Jefferson. Now, let me sort of switch gears now and give you two clear examples, I think, of political entrepreneurship versus market entrepreneurship from some of my own writing. And this is the sort of thing that I encourage you, those of you who are considering doing some kind of research or term papers for school or whatever, to look into, think about doing this kind of research. And I have a chapter in one of my books on the building of the American Transcontinental Railroads. There were two types of transcontinental railroads. One was the government-subsidized transcontinental railroads, the Union Pacific and the Northern Pacific. And they were given massive government subsidies in the form of low-interest subsidized loans and millions of acres of free land for them. Then there was the Great Northern Railroad, built by James J. Hill, a private entrepreneur who used private capital and no government land grants. He purchased the rights of way through the Indian lands by giving the Indians livestock, money, or whatever they would trade for, whereas the government-subsidized railroads would just murder all the Indians. They'd call in Sherman's army, and they could just wipe them all out. By then, they had machine guns, you know, Gatling guns and artillery against, you know, the Indians with the bows and arrows. And they did have repeating rifles. And And they did have repeating rifles when Custer was killed in the Battle of Little Bighorn, for those of the Americans in the audience. And that's an interesting story. And for those of you who know about this, Custer's last stand, where he and his troops in the 1870s were killed by the – all wiped out by the Sioux. The United States Army had a policy at that time. They said they weren't going to give the soldiers repeating rifles because they used too much ammunition. I think it was the quartermaster general of the U.S. Army said that. But the Indians, fortunately for them, did not have a quartermaster general. But they did have repeating rifles, though. And so that would be sort of the equivalent of Custer and his men with bows and arrows and the Indians with repeating rifles. And anyway, that's kind of a not really relevant to my lecture here, but it's kind of a fun story since I'm talking about this period of history. But here's James J. Hill. Here's a description of James J. Hill and how he went about his business in building a privately funded Transcontinental Railroad. And this is from a biographer of Hill named Burton Folsom. Hill's quest for short routes, low grades, and a few curvatures was an obsession. In 1889, Hill conquered the Rocky Mountains by finding the legendary Marias Pass. Lewis and Clark had described a low pass through the Rockies back in 1805, but later no one seemed to know whether it really existed or, if it did, where it was. Hill wanted the best gradient, so much that he hired a man to spend months searching western Montana for this legendary pass. He did, in fact, find it, and the ecstatic Hill shortened his route by almost 100 miles. And so he was famous for being sort of like a John D. Rockefeller type, with no stone unturned, for efficiency in building his railroad. And as a result, his biographer said he had the best built, most efficiently built, and most profitable railroad line in the entire world at the time. And this was in the 1880s when he built his railroad. Now compare that to the same author, Burton Folsom, describing the government subsidized railroad. The chief engineer of the government subsidized railroad was a man named Grenville Dodge, who was an old pal of Abe Lincoln's during the Civil War era. And they commenced this, of course, during the Civil War. This all started this. And Dodge was made a general by Lincoln, even though he was not a military man. But his job was basically to organize the killing off of Indians who were in the way of where they planned on building the railroad. But here's what Folsom says. And they were in a big hurry to build this government-subsidized railroad, and the subsidies from the government were per-mile subsidies. So every mile of track you built, you know, more subsidy. And you can think of some perverse incentives that could be created by that. So here's what Burton Folsom says. He says, since Dodge was in a hurry, he laid track on the ice and snow in the wintertime. Naturally, the line had to be rebuilt in the spring. But of course, if the line had to be rebuilt, that's twice the profit. The government, the taxpayers are paying for it. Of course, no private entrepreneur would do something so stupid to double his cost, but the government subsidized ones did. Naturally, the line had to be rebuilt in the spring. What was worse, unanticipated spring flooding along the lower fork of the Platte River washed out rails, bridges, and telephone poles, doing at least $50,000 damage in the first year. No wonder some observers estimated the actual building cost at almost three times what it should have been. And so that's a political entrepreneur. And Folsom goes on to explain what Grenville Dodge and his partner, Thomas Durant, how they spent their time. James J. Hill, the private businessman, of course, spent his time, you know, every waking moment, if you read his biography, of figuring out how to make the route cheaper, better. He subsidized the farmers along the route. He gave them free livestock. He gave them seeds. He gave them agricultural experts, because he knew if the farmers did not succeed, neither would his railroad. You know, who's gonna need a railroad if the farmers are all bankrupt and gone? And so he, no stone unturned. By contrast, here's a passage from Folsom explaining how Thomas Durant, the head of the Union Pacific, he said, in 1866, Thomas Durant wined and dined 150 prominent citizens, including senators and ambassador and government bureaucrats, along a completed section of the railroad. He hired an orchestra, a caterer, six cooks, a magician, to pull subsidies out of a hat, in parentheses, and a photographer. For those with ecumenical palates, he served Chinese duck and Roman goose. The more adventurous were offered roast ox and antelope. These were all senators, congressmen, governors. Okay. All could have expensive wine, and for dessert, strawberries, peaches, and cherries. After dinner, some of the men hunted buffalo from their coaches. Durant hoped that all would go back to Washington, inclined to repay the Union Pacific for its hospitality. And so, and a lot of these same people, politicians, were given shares of stock in the various companies associated with the building of the railroads. And so the actual roots of the railroads speak volumes, too. I have here a map of the United States that I've drawn. Might not be 100% accurate, but there's tiny New York, an inconsequential New York City. There's Auburn there, but this is not the exact. I guess I could have printed out James J. Hill's route. It's online. You could Google it. But his route, more or less, you know, from the Midwest. To carry all the grain and the farm goods from the Midwest to the Pacific, wound its way through the Rocky Mountains in whatever way they could. They found this famous pass in Montana that knocked off 100 miles from the route and everything. And so it was pretty efficient. It wasn't that straight. I've seen the actual route. It's not quite that straight, but close to it. In contrast, here's what the if you were to look up the map online of the Union Pacific, it would look more like this. Something like that. Because one of the reasons it looked like that was that in order to get subsidies from the government, you had to get votes. So every member of Congress and even politicians from the territories that were not yet part of the United States held them hostage because they had some say. They were about to become states. New Mexico was about to become a state. And so the politicians there had some clout. And so, build a line to my state capital or to my town or no vote for me. And so they had to have these circuitous railroad tracks that would touch on every congressional district. Along the way, or else no money for you. Whereas James J. Hill, he was a profit maximizer, which is the flip side of cost minimizer. That's how you make money in business. Cost minimization, as we teach in microeconomics, is really the flip side of profit maximization. That's how you do it. And so, so that's pretty much how they did it. And so those are some of the examples. Now, as far as our theme here of political entrepreneurship and wealth destruction, you know, the classical theory of democracy that you're taught, well, some people are taught in school, is really sort of a perfectly competitive model of government, isn't it? People are more or less taught that the citizens express their preferences at the election time, and then the politicians faithfully give them what they want, in a democracy. That's why democracies are so much superior to autarky or, monarchies and other forms of government, supposedly. So really, it does sound like the theory of perfect competition, though, doesn't it, where businesses are, with perfect information, perfectly comply with the demands of consumers because they have perfect knowledge of the demands of consumers. And that's the whole story. And that really is the classical theory of democracy. And even the public choice literature in economics, which is very critical of the classical theory of democracy and of government in general, has kind of a version of that. It's called the median voter model. And the model goes something like this. Start with a straight line and draw a bell curve. And put a line down the middle of the bell curve. And what this bell curve is the distribution of voters in a country by ideology, left and right. I put L and R. So over here you have the commies. When I explain this in one of my classrooms, I put names under the commies, you know, who might be included in this. And I usually put the university administration and the arts and sciences and humanities faculty. And over here you have Walter Block. And then you have the anarcho-capitalist right about there. Here's Walter over here. I'm getting a little bit of hair. The median voter model is pretty simple and straightforward. It was actually started by a political scientist named Anthony Downs, and then my old professor, Gordon Tullock, wrote a lot about it. This was back in the 50s and 60s, and then there's a huge literature with all sorts of changes and variants in the mathematical modeling. But the original model says that... most people are middle of the road. Most people, in terms of ideology, so people don't vote in elections according to some, not most people anyway, according to specific issues. They don't know, have any idea how it might affect them financially, that, you know, in any specificity. So they sort of equate themselves ideologically. You know, I'm more like this person than that person. I'm a Hillary Clintonite. And I've already seen some, I'm just saying some people might say that. But I've already seen some bumper stickers that say, I'm ready for Hillary. And I don't know what to take by, if I see one of those in Maryland, well, then I know it's some left-wing dingbat. But if I see one in Alabama, it's probably, you know, I'm buying ammunition. You know, I'm at Dick's Sporting Goods right now, but loading up on ammunition. I'm ready for Hillary. You know, so you don't know what to think when you see this thing. So people do that, or you know, the true libertarian will say, "I'm ready for Romney." You know, he'll be buying that. That was a joke, by the way. Also, you know, what's the difference? The story goes something like this. What if the election season starts and the left wing guy stakes out this position, a guy or a gal? Here's Hillary. Goes out, gives speeches, or their surrogates give speeches, go on television, and the person on the right stakes out, let's say, this position, R1. And the midpoint between those two positions is this dotted line. And there's more votes to the right of the dotted line under the bell curve than the left. So that if the person on the left wants to compete in this election, Hillary's going to have to move to the right. So you might see Hillary getting her picture taken with an infantryman's helmet, a tank captain's helmet on, sitting on top of a tank in an army place, something like that, or parachuting onto an aircraft carrier or something like that. You know, Michael Dukakis, when he ran for president way back when, I think what really killed him when he lost was he was way over here to the left. He was the governor of Massachusetts, you know, Taxachusetts, they used to call it, and very liberal, very left-wing. And so he tried to move to the right in a very clunky way. And he was a very tiny guy. He kind of looked like the little man on the top of the wedding cake, Michael Dukakis. And he did this. He had his picture taken in a tank, and it looked like there was an empty tank somewhere and a squirrel got in it somehow, popped his head up. You know, and it was Michael Dukakis. And so it was like ridiculed. Everybody laughed, and it didn't work. It didn't work. So anyway, they'll have to try. Bill Clinton was the master at that. You know, he was very good at that. He sounded like William F. Buckley Jr. when he was running for president. He was good at He's a very good liar. He's the best liar I can remember in my lifetime in politics. Very good at it. And it worked for him very well. And so we have to move to the right. And if they move all the way over here, there's L2. Well, then now the midpoint between L2 and R1 is over here, so that the left-wing candidate will win the election if it's held today. And, of course, if it's not held today, the right-winger will have to move to the left. I can remember Reagan promising... saying that welfare spending increased more in his first 4 years than it did under the Carter administration. It was his attempt to move a little bit to the left anyway. So the moral of the story is whoever does the best job of aligning themselves with the median voter in the middle on election day will win the election. Okay, so the median voter gets what they want, but no one else does. Everybody who wants more government over here, you're screwed. You can't get more government. Everybody who wants less government over here, yeah, you're screwed too because you can't get it. Because in democracy, it's all or none voting. You can't say, I voted for Hillary and she's my president if she loses the election. It's all or none. Whether it's the election, local election in Auburn, Alabama, or the presidential election, it's not like the market where if I like Coke and you like Pepsi, we can each have what we want. If we use democracy for Coke and Pepsi and Coke wins, sorry, you're going to have to drink Coke. You can't drink Pepsi. If we use democracy for determining men's shoe sizes and we decide all shoes to be sold are going to be size 9B, well, then you're in trouble if you're not 9B. If you have wear size 13 like me, you have to probably have to buy two pairs of 9B and cut them up and make another pair. Doesn't work that way. Okay. But, so this is, the public choice model. It's sort of similar to the classical theory of democracy, but there are a lot of problems with that. In that this implies that at least the median voters get what they want under the political regime. But then you've got the phenomenon of log rolling that says, well, no, the median voter doesn't really get what they want. Here's an example of log rolling. This is an example of what would happen in a local election, locally Auburn, Alabama, where there are three groups of voters, A, B, and C. And these are their true preferences for two different things, two different proposals. Should we spend more money on schools, raise the tax a little bit around here, or should we raise the tax a little bit and spend more on hospitals? So group A would be younger people with children, therefore more spending on schools because they have kids in school, but they're healthy. They don't want to spend any more money on hospitals. We already have hospitals. Then you have people whose kids are already out of school. They don't want no more school spending, but they would like to see more hospital spending. They're getting older and they're going to need hospital care, they know. So they would vote for more hospital spending. Then the third group, they're happy with the status quo. They don't want more spending on either schools or hospitals. And so in a democracy, you need a majority. And so if you were to have a referendum on school spending, you would not get a majority here. You would only have one vote, one third. Are in favor of more school spending. Group B, which is, well, I'm assuming these are equally numbered groups, they don't want more schools, and neither does Group C, so it wouldn't work. If you held a referendum, should we raise the property tax a little to build more hospitals, you'd only get one-third. That wouldn't pass. You'd get Group B would vote for more hospitals, but A and C would be against it. And so the true preferences of the voters would leave us with the status quo, spending what we're spending now on schools and hospitals. That would be the true preferences of the median voter in this community. But with log rolling, a deal can be made, and this happens in Congress every single day, all day long, not so much among groups in the community, but it does sometimes. But certainly in Congress, A could say to B, we don't really give a crap about hospitals, but we will hold our noses and vote for more hospitals if, when our vote comes up for more schools, you, who do not give a crap about more schools, vote for more schools. Okay, the deal is done. So vote trading takes place. It's called log rolling. So as a result of that, even though the true preferences are no more spending on anything, that's the median voter's preferences, the actual result is more spending on everything with log rolling. And so government becomes more or less unlimited with this thing, with log rolling. Then another trick of the political entrepreneur, that's a trick of the political entrepreneur. Another trick of the political entrepreneur is something called agenda control, where you can set the agenda of how votes are taken. Okay. And let me give you a trivial example. Some people at a different university where I used to work, when it comes time to hire people and hire new professors, there's politics. Believe it or not, there's politics in academia. Who would ever thought? But I remember just sitting back and being entertained by all this because I was a younger professor, and not that I ever had any clout in economics departments. But I was just watching this, and the people who wanted to hire, they had one person they really wanted to hire, so they were sort of in charge of all the interviewing process, and they had four candidates, and so they had the one they wanted to hire. And then they picked, the other three were like the absolute worst, least qualified they could find anywhere in the world, and brought them to campus for interviews, and they're just horrible. You went to school, you know, and so, you know, so they controlled the agenda so to guarantee that their person would win, because the other three just looked so horrible compared to it. And that happens in politics a lot, where the agenda can be controlled. And another trick is what Tom Woods mentioned. He actually mentioned that I've written about this a few times. It's called the Washington Monument Syndrome. And what this is another trick of the political entrepreneur. And let me give you an example. Tom explained the Washington Monument, why it's called the Washington Monument Syndrome. Let me give you a real example. I lived in Buffalo, New York for 1 year of my life, and that was more than enough for me with all the snow and the cold and all that. But the year I was there, they were having they had several referenda that were voted on school spending. They wanted to raise the property taxes, to spend more money on education, you know, schools. And so they took the vote in the fall election, and it lost big. It was lost like 3/4 against it. And so the school system announced, and in Buffalo, New York, you know, if election time is the first week of November, you're well into winter. It's snowing and snowing every day. And they said, well, we can't afford any school bus service. We're going to have to eliminate school buses. And so your kids are going to have to walk to school, or you're going to have to drive them to school. And in Buffalo, New York, in the wintertime, when it snows, at least that year it did all day. It seemed like every day, all night, snow, snow, snow. Yeah, you wake up in the middle of the night, all you can hear is the grinding of the snow plows, and there are no sidewalks. You know, the snow's this high. So the kids walking to school, they're like tiptoeing on the side of the road, you know, in the dark at 7 o'clock in the morning. And so they took another referendum, and surprise, it passed. So it's a way of extorting money from the taxpayers. And this is very routine. Whenever a government doesn't get what it wants, the first thing to go is police, firemen, garbage collection, whatever will inflict the most pain and discomfort on the taxpayers. That's what goes. You know, there's never any fat or any unnecessary items that can be eliminated. That's the Washington Monument Syndrome. Now, the next trick of the political entrepreneur that I think that also kind of blows out of the water is even the median voter theory that says that at least the median voter gets what they want is gerrymandering. Well, the word, I looked up, if you look it up on Wikipedia or someplace, it says it comes from, there was a politician named Elbridge Gerry who was associated with this trick. And mandering comes from salamander, you know, the lizard, salamander. You know, salamander is kind of a squiggly little lizard. It looks kind of like this, you know. salamander. And what gerrymandering is the drawing of congressional districts in a way that guarantees that the incumbents will always win. And for example, if you had, I'll do another piece of artwork. Let's say this is the state of Alabama. Here's a map of the state of Alabama. And let's say there are a number of congressional districts. Well, how do you decide what the districts are going to be? Well, you could make it like this. You know, District 1, District 2, District 3, District 4. That could be the four congressional districts of Alabama. Or you could draw, here's the state of Alabama again on the other side of this paper. You could have one that looks like this, you know, one that looks like that, you know, the other one up here and the other one down there. That could be the four districts. There's 1, 2, 3, 4. That could be the four districts. Now, why on earth would you do something like that? Well, what gerrymandering is they get the politicians get a hold of whoever's in the governor's house gets a hold of the voter registration records, and they draw the districts. If you're a Democrat and you're governor, you find out where all the Democrats live, and you make sure that in every district that is drawn, there's maybe 70 to 80% Democrats in that district, and so that it'll guarantee that a Democrat is always going to win that district. And then when that governor loses to a Republican, if that Republican happens to be in office when the next redrawing of the districts occurs, usually every 10 years, the Republican will do the exact same thing. And so I brought in a printout of the top 10 most gerrymandered congressional districts in America. And here's what some of them actually look like. That's near Charlotte, North Carolina. And the bottom one is in Miami-Dade in Florida. Okay, here's one in Pennsylvania. Yeah, that's a logical way to draw a congressional district, isn't it? Pennsylvania. There's another North Carolina district, and there's one in Georgia. Some of you may see your hometown in there somewhere. This is Georgia again, not too far from here. This is Calhoun, Georgia. Okay. Here's a nice one. Here's the Palm Beach County, Florida. Look at all that. I mean, these things here are probably individual condo developments with elderly retirees from New York City. And so, and there's another, where's this at? Arizona. Here's another good one. Look at this one. That's Maryland. That's a Maryland congressional district. And one more. This printout of mine says this is the most ridiculous. And naturally, it's Illinois near Chicago.
That's one district.
It's all one district. It's separated by all this stuff in the middle. It's a different district. It's not even contiguous. It's two different chunks of Cook County, Illinois. So that's why if you look at the reelection rates in the U.S. House of Representatives, this is what you see. if you were to draw, the average, since 1964. This starts in 1964. It looks to be at least 90%. Some years, if you look at like in 2004, it looks like about 99% in 2004. But it's been in the 90% range since 1964. That's the U.S. House of Representatives. And this is the United States Senate, which is not quite as egregious, but pretty close to it. And so this is why you can do pretty much anything. As Bob Higgs once said to me, the only reason we have free speech is that the government knows it doesn't matter what we say. They can, we're not going to unseat anybody. They have the system rigged so that, talk all you want, it doesn't really matter what we do. I can even remember some years ago when in the front page of the Washington Post for a whole week was, I was surprised at this because it was a well-known Democrat who was involved in a scandal, and the Washington Post had it in the front page for a week. They usually only with Republicans would put a scandal on the front page for a week, but this was Barney Frank from Massachusetts, and it was just too juicy for the Washington Post, because his male partner, was running a house of prostitution from the bottom floor of his townhouse on Capitol Hill. And Barney claimed he had no idea what all those people and all the cars all night long coming and going was about. But then Barney was reelected, 10 or 12 times after that. So you can even run a whorehouse in your house, in your home, and it doesn't matter, I grew up in Pennsylvania, and there was a congressman named Flood. And if you ever watched the old Bullwinkle and Rocky cartoons, even the younger people here, you could go online and watch anything, see anything these days. But there was a bad guy named Snidely Whiplash in the old Bullwinkle cartoons. And Congressman Flood looked just like Snidely Whiplash. He had a handlebar mustache, way out to here. He wore a cape, black cape, and a big black fedora, big black hat. What a character. And he was a rotten crook like all the rest of them. And he was indicted on a felony charge. And Pennsylvania, you know, the election laws are all different in every state. And so even though he was indicted, he wasn't convicted, he could still run. That was the way it was in Pennsylvania. He ran and he won. He won re-election, even though it was all over the news, you know, this thing he was accused of. And everybody knew he was guilty of this. And I remember reading articles in the local papers where the reporters would ask the man on the street, "Did you vote for Congressman Flood?" "Yes." "Well, why could you vote for him, a man like that?" And they all said the same thing. They all said, "Well, yeah, he's a crook, but they're all crooks, but he's really good at bringing back the highway grants and the post office grants. And so as long as he keeps bringing back the money to Pennsylvania, who cares? They're all crooks," they said, which is true. That was a very rational thing to do. And so it's not just gerrymandering. There are barriers to entry into politics. Because, you know, they prohibit third parties, essentially. You have to get, what is it now, 30 million signatures for a third party? I'm making that up, but you have to get, tens of thousands of signatures to run for Congress on a third party ticket. My old friend James Bennett wrote a whole book about this a few years ago, and he got Ron Paul and Ralph Nader to endorse it, to give him blurbs for it. And they also, members of Congress, have taxpayer-funded staff, who are all really taxpayer-funded campaign staff. And so any challenger who challenges them has to do it the old-fashioned way, has to raise money and get volunteers to work for us. That makes it tougher. And so that's another thing that creates this result of the incumbents almost never losing. So we've got monopoly government, much more than median voter government. Tricks of the political entrepreneur. Now, keep in mind, all of these tricks are designed to isolating the political entrepreneur from being pressured in any way from the voters. Whereas with the market entrepreneur, they have to cater to their voters, the people who vote with the dollars. They do everything they can to be good to their voters. The people who vote with their dollars, or else the voters, so-called, won't give them the dollars. But the political entrepreneur does all these things to say voter schmoter. You know, they make speeches about how great democracy is, but then they work behind the scenes to do all these things to make sure that the voter has, the people have nothing whatsoever to do with what they're up to. You know, when is the last time any average voter had anything whatsoever to do with foreign policy, for example? You know, when the U.S. government is trying to instigate a war in Syria or now a war in Russia, what do we have to do with it? You know, it's like there's a couple dozen people in a room somewhere who are doing all of this, and they like it that way. That's the way they like it. They don't want us to have much of anything to do with it. Okay. Another trick is based on a book I published a long time ago with James Bennett. It's called Underground Government: The Off-Budget Public Sector. At the time, we were interested in how governments would respond to tax revolts. In the United States in the 70s and early 80s, there were several dozen pretty serious tax revolts at the state and local level of government. And I guess you could even argue that the election of Ronald Reagan was the result of a tax revolt of sorts. But a number of states, the most famous was Proposition 13 in California that limited the growth of property taxes. But there were several dozen states that did things like that. They placed limits on property taxes, on government borrowing, government spending. There were even some county governments that did that. There's a county government even in Maryland, in liberal Maryland, that they ended up, they put a law into place that said that the property taxes can't go up faster than personal income goes up the previous year, you know, things like that. And so we wanted to know, is there any history out there that will tell us what politicians are likely to do? Are they going to faithfully comply and say, yes, the people have spoken, we will cut taxes and cut spending, or at least reduce the growth of spending like the median voter model would tell us, or wouldn't they, or to do something else? And what we found is that, and we wrote the whole book about it, is that for well over 100 years, politicians have done that. They've said, yes, the voters have spoken. We will limit our borrowing. We're not going to borrow it anymore. You know, we have too much debt. And at the same time, they set up what we called off-budget enterprises, off-budget government enterprises. And these are enterprises that are funded by the issuance of what are called revenue bonds. And revenue bonds do not require voter approval. And it was Nixon's attorney general, John Mitchell, who went to jail, by the way, who was a champion of this. He invented a new kind of a revenue bond called the moral obligation bond. And it said that if the state of New York issued a bond, then it was not backed up by any revenue that would come from the state of New York Treasury, but the state had a moral obligation to make sure the bond was paid off. And so they got away, and these didn't require voter approval. So the politicians could go ahead, they would build housing projects, university dormitories, all sorts of things without voter approval, because the voters, when they did take a referendum and the voters would vote no, they would say, okay, and thumb their noses at the voters, and say, we're going to do it anyway. We'll fund it with revenue bonds, and we're going to charge rent in the college dormitory, and that'll pay off the revenue bonds. But it never did. It was never enough to pay off the revenue bonds. And the worst example of this, of the consequence of this, was there was something called the Washington Public Power Supply System in the American Northwest. The acronym was pronounced WHOOPS at the time. And they issued over $5 billion in debt, in the revenue bond debt, to supposedly build five nuclear power plants. And they built them with the efficiency of Thomas Durant of the Union Pacific, the guy that I quoted from. And so none of them got finished after about 15 years or so. And the people, the bondholders, were stuck. They defaulted on $2.5 billion in municipal debt. And there were a number of states. It wasn't just Washington. It was Oregon, Idaho was in on it. And it was called WHOOPS. And so that's another trick of the trade that's used to avoid any kind of pressure by the people. And maybe I'll quit my talk there. We have, I guess we have 2 minutes for any questions or brilliant announcements or pronunciations or declarations anyone would like to make from the class.
Well, I would comment on what you're saying.
Yeah, that's true. And if there's a swing vote, so-called, then yeah, everybody's liberty is in the hands of one person in a black robe deity. And I actually, in some of my writings, I actually quoted Jefferson himself, and even one of his law professors, St. George Tucker, who was the adoptive father of John Randolph. And he was a very prominent legal scholar of his day, said that if a day were to come when the people would rely solely on the federal judiciary on their liberties, then Americans would live under a tyranny. And this was 200 years ago. And that's that day came, by the way, at the very end of the American Civil War. The Civil War was the breaking point. Before that, you had Andrew Jackson when Chief Justice John Marshall issued his opinion that the Bank of the United States was constitutional. The president, Andrew Jackson, said essentially, he said, thank you for your opinion, but my opinion is different, and I'm president, and my opinion is just as important as your opinion on this. And it was. It was at that time. But it was only after the American Civil War that the federal government nationalized the Constitution, and there was no longer an equal opinion by the president, by Congress, or the people of the states. It was the judiciary. And John Marshall, by the way, invented judicial review. The words judicial review do not appear in the Constitution. He invented this out of thin air. It's basically saying, I, John Marshall, will tell you what's constitutional, since he was the Chief Justice of his day. Anything else? Well, I guess it's lunchtime then. It's time to put on the feed bag. And, thank you.